Good morning and welcome to our virtual meeting. It's 9 a.m. on September 7th, 2021, and time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. In accordance with the Governor's Proclamation 20-28.15, we are holding meetings remotely. With me today is Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, our Vice President, Commissioner Tony Olson, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO General Manager, Ann Spangler, our General Counsel, Melissa Collins, our Commission Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, our Assistant Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Lila Wall, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute and turn off the camera on your devices when not speaking. This session is for the Board and CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. If there's public requests to comment and time remains in the morning, 15 minutes will be allowed at the end of the briefing session. So first up, agenda one, CEO General Manager briefing and study session. Good morning, John.
Good morning, commissioners. I hope everybody enjoyed this long weekend. And looks like we're in for a beautiful, sunny Pacific Northwest day. We've got some good things on the agenda today. And first up is Julie Cunningham with our media update. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, John. Good morning, commissioners. It's always good to be back after a nice long three-day weekend. I love those. We've been busy, though. We've been in the news a bunch with all sorts of good things. I'll start with that the Department of Commerce announcing the grants we recently received. We had news about that in the microgrid knowledge and also in the Washington State Department of Commerce talking about getting grant funds for our projects, our microgrid project. We were in the Everett Herald when they did an editorial about the infrastructure bill. We were included in that talking about getting dollars for electric vehicles, something else that was very positive. We were in Clearing Up on a story about the new power pool program. And I believe Garrison Marr had a nice comment for us about that. That helped us get through the heat wave in June. So it's proved to be a good tool for us to be part of. This last month, we had a brief outage in near Alderwood Mall, and that was caused by birds getting into the equipment, which is something a little unusual for us. And in the Edmonds Beacon, we were part of a story on broadband and talking about different options about broadband, also pretty positive. My favorite is we've been talking about fish. We have the wonderful Andrew McDonald and Kyle Laguerre, and we had a story this weekend in the Everett Herald talking about all the wonderful stats that we have on our fish. And it's also in this month's Northwest Public Power Association bulletin, page 24, if you want to take a look at that. Same kind of story featuring our local, our own utilities and all the cool work we're doing. So really love those kind of stories, as you know. A couple other quick things I did want to address quickly that at the last meeting, I know Commissioner Wolf, you expressed concern over communications and the fact that we're called corporate communications. I did want you to know that we're actually communications, marketing, and business readiness. And a lot of times we're called CorpCom because we also have telecom here. So it's more I always think of it as a fondness up till now that people just call us CorpCom rather than calling us telecom. It kind of distinguishes us. So I did want to make sure you knew that our official title is not actually CorpCom. It's just a shortcut to it. So something to be aware of. I know you feel corporation has some negative connotations with people. And then finally, go ahead. Sorry, excuse me.
No, I was aware of the market readiness part of it. And yeah, it's just, I have had concerns about the interpretation of corp, the CorpCom. But thank you, Julie.
Yeah, you bet. It's more a shortcut that people use to distinguish us. But I just wanted to make sure everyone knew that was it's a common term for the department, that's for sure. And then lastly, the fair wrapped up. It was a different and new kind of way. I have to do a shout out to Laura Zorick, who helped pull it all together in a very changing, constantly changing kind of atmosphere that we're in right now. The team over at Ops did a great job at bringing the ARC trailer in. It was very popular. A huge shout out and thank you to all of the employees who were willing to work when, you know, pretty much at the last minute after they signed up, they were told they would need to wear masks the whole time. And they did, and they showed up. And I just want to say, and I know Commissioner Logan, you had a chance to get out there and work at the booth. It is such a wonderful reinforcement to how loved we are in our community. I mean, we are just person after person who worked the booth shared and expressed that we are always so appreciated. And there's very few customers who express real dismay with the utility. It's always a good chance to hear from our customers out there about how much we really are highly regarded. So it was super cool. Another good year of the fair in a whole new location. So even that worked out well. That's it for me.
Questions for Julie? Comments?
Thank you.
I will say Laura did a great job with the fair. It was the new booth worked out well, and it was good for airflow in and out of there, so it felt safer. And kudos to that wonderful story in the Herald on the Salton River. It's just wonderful that we can keep getting that word out. And so
we were excited. It played so well. It was great.
Yeah.
Just a follow-up to your comment, Commissioner Logan, I agree. Laura and the entire team, including the folks from Ops on the ARC trailer, did a fantastic job. I know Julie was pulling her hair out along the way. It was pretty frustrating, not sure how things were going to go. But again, as usual, the team just crushed it, and everything worked out very, very well. And again, did us very proud at the fair and both accounts. So great job, Julie.
Thank you. I'll pass that along.
Oh, next up is on the agenda is the legislative update, and the GR team is here for questions regarding anything that was in the packet for this week.
Any questions, commissioners, on what's in the packet?
I just always really appreciate having these updates and the good reads. Thank you.
No, it was interesting to read how PSC is looking to get to clean energy. So that was an interesting piece, although they wrote the piece, but still interesting.
Excellent. And again, I agree. Huge kudos to Kim and Kim Johnson and her team. They do a fantastic job putting all that information together and making it really easy to look through and understand. So next up on the agenda is the procurement of our meter installation vendor and the services, and that is going to be from Travis Olson. Good morning, Travis.
Hey, good morning, John. Good morning, commissioners.
Morning.
Good morning.
All right. So I'm here. Thank you for thank you for having me this morning. I'm here to kind of bring a quick overview of our meter installation vendor RFP, as well as to provide a staff recommendation to authorize Aclara Smart Grid Solutions as the district's MIV and work order management system provider. So just a quick agenda of what we're kind of going to get into. We'll talk about the meter installation vendor. Kind of the overall RFP process, some of the services that are being provided, the RFP timeline, as well as a couple different components, different aspects of the agreements, including the professional service agreement and then the work order management system lease, and then touch base on the costs, staff recommendation, and then finally next steps. So this should be somewhat familiar. This is a slide that's you've probably seen a number of times now throughout the different aspects of AMI or the Connect Up project. This one has been updated since your 6/23 workshop. So just wanted to point that out. The only update is just kind of the pictures of the meters and the handheld, just to give a little more clarity to what the MIV brings to the table. So again, there's four agreements needed to implement AMI: the AMI vendor, the meter data management system, the systems integrator, all of which have been already are under contract and are already in the process of work. And finally, this is the fourth piece of that, which is the meter installation vendor. And so this agreement includes a couple different aspects. The first is a professional services side of it, where we are asking to the meter installation vendor to assist the district with its logistical setup and physical exchange of all of its meters throughout the district, both electric and water. So some of those services include the blueprinting workshops, which were already underway, the warehouse setup consulting, detailed deployment planning and best practices, as well as ongoing deployment support. And then the second part of it is a work order management system, or WOMS, and their particular solution is called Profield. And this is the handheld app that we will use for mass deployment to help streamline in the efficiency of doing this versus kind of the manual process that we have today. So the work order management system includes the configurations and setup, the systems integration and testing, training, and then ongoing WOMS support. So a little brief timeline of our RFP. If you recall, the first iteration started actually last year in late 2020. And then we changed direction a little bit and went with internal employees for the actual exchange. So that RFP hit the street on 6/4 earlier this year. We received 7 proposals, 2 of which were shortlisted towards the end of July, including Aclara and Contract Callers. And then finally on 8/6, we came to the conclusion out of Aclara as selected as the finalist. And then on 8/30, we completed the contract negotiations as they're related to the PSC and scope of work. So there's two components that they provide. Again, the professional services contract, which is that the consulting services and expertise, and then the WOMS licensing agreement. And this will be a license throughout the duration of the project, and it will provide kind of 3 different pieces: the Profield server, which is where all the application server and all the information is stored; the Profield web, this is the web application for management and office support staff to assist in the scheduling, running reports, all those types of back office work; and then the Profield field, and this is the app that will actually be used by the vendors or by the exchange technicians out in the field. So the costs came in at just under $700,000, broken up into those 2 pieces. So this first piece that we're presenting today is for $387,000. And then the second piece, which will be coming back, our goal is to come back on the October 4th commission meeting with the leasing agreement for just under $300,000. And so a total of 686. And just want to point out that our business case presentation from 6/1, we had estimated this at 1.88 million. So we came in quite a bit under our estimate. So the staff recommends the authorization of Aclara as the district's meter installation vendor based on a few different things. It's the best overall solution that we felt to serve the district's needs, both for the professional and consulting services and the expertise that Aclara brings to the table, as well as the work order management system that meets all the key technical requirements for doing the actual exchange. And then in addition, this was the lowest overall total project cost. So next steps, this afternoon on consent agenda, we'll get consideration in the afternoon for the first of 2 agreements with Aclara. And again, this is for the professional services agreement in the amount of $387,976. And then the district is continuing to negotiate the licensing and services agreement with the anticipated goal of getting on the 10/4 commission meeting. And that amount again is for $298,125, or for a total project or total MIV expense or cost of $686,000 and change.
Any questions? Thank you. I have a question about the pre-tax. Could you say more about what will happen regarding taxes?
Help me understand what you mean by that.
I don't understand pre-tax.
So that was just the bid pre-tax, and then tax will be applied after such.
This is Commissioner Olson. I guess I'd look to the clerks or council to weigh in on this. I had thought that the RCW, the award is based on pre-tax for RCW.
Commissioner Olson,
Is that just public works?
I'd have to go verify that. This is Ann Spangler. It's just, we use that as a way of expressing the amount of the contract. We use the pre-tax figure as opposed to a taxed figure, but I can go verify.
I think it's public works and materials, but I may be wrong. It's been a long time ago, but this is consulting services.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
So who gets the tax money? I mean, is that a state tax, federal tax? And are we taxed by Aclara?
They're state taxes. So the state will get them.
Okay.
We are not being taxed.
Just, you know, I feel like I should understand how that works. So is there an estimate of how much tax there will be? Is it just like the 10% sales tax? I mean, I don't understand what the tax would be. Or do we know?
I don't know off the top of my head. I'd have to go check.
Well, you're supposed to know everything, Anne. Okay, well, maybe the answer will become clear. But
we can get that for you this afternoon.
Okay, thank you very much.
Not sure if Scott's on the call, but he could likely answer. But I think this is just the same type of tax that we get, that we pay for all of our goods and services.
Yeah, correct. The only thing, John, I was going to add, and we can get you the very specifics, Commissioner Wolf, and Ann and I can kind of get our heads together. We generally will pay some kinds of taxes on certain purchases and materials and occasionally services that we procure. And some of those things depend on the project. They could be exempt at times. So we generally will remove the tax question from the bid so we can focus on the actual services and the equipment. And then the taxes kind of fall out the way they fall out, depending on the guidelines for the particular kinds of equipment. And we're talking about a few percentage points one way or the other. I mean, we're not going to be taxed for, you know, numbers in the, you know, 20 or 30 or 40% kinds of ranges. We're talking about, you know, typically single digit kinds of numbers on equipment purchases typically. But we're happy to get you a lot more specifics on that.
I hope you don't object to my being interested in that. I just kind of like to understand like what it's going to cost, period. You know, so I didn't know how much that might be. I'm not so much that I need it to the penny, that kind of thing, but just the bigger picture of how it works. And that was really helpful, Scott.
Yeah, it's a perfectly fair question, because the reality is the district does pay taxes, and we have a sizable amount of cash outflow that's related to taxes. It's not something that we can avoid. It's part of the business. Mm-hmm. Really the attempt on the bid side is to try to focus that conversation on the quality of the services and the equipment themselves, and mm-hmm. to get the bids focused on what the people are providing. And then the taxes, of course, are just an adder to that. But it's a perfectly good question, and we'll be more than happy to give you any info you want. I'll circle back with Ann and others on our side too.
All right. Thanks, Scott. This is Commissioner Olson. Can you please also include, to correct my memory about the material and the public works? in terms of how it's presented pre-tax.
I'll confirm that with Clark. I don't know if Clark is on the call yet.
I may be wrong. You know, I may be wrong, but for some reason that came
to mind. Yeah, I know we're not exempt from normal sales and use tax.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, so, I get that. You
know, we'll typically have to pay it, but I'm not. Ann, I'm sure, is looking into a definitive answer on this too, yeah, but it doesn't surprise me. And again, I'm still feel a little bit new here to all the nuances of our stuff, but it doesn't surprise me that we would exclude taxes in the consideration. A lot of companies typically do that,
yeah.
Because Why? The tax piece of it is, well, because the tax piece can be a different animal. Vendors can actually withhold some taxes sometimes. And so if you sort of level the playing field and say, let's exclude taxes from the conversation, then yeah, it kind of gets us all on an even playing field on evaluating services and equipment. And then we can figure out what the taxes are over and above that.
I agree with you.
Yep.
Right. And it's my recollection that this is not mandated by statute, but I'll verify that.
Okay.
Any other questions for Travis? Or about taxes? Travis, I just have one question. So this is this pro field. This would be the device that installers would take to your home, right? And they would record where the current meter, what number that meter is, what the actual reading is, and then the new meter, and then it would facilitate changing that over in our customer portals and all those things. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, it's basically just an app, and our goal is to have it on just like a employee's iPhone. So they'll walk up, take pictures of the meter before and after, take pictures of the read, enter the read into the pro field. Then there's a QA QC process that goes on overnight, an overseas process where they go and match up the picture to the read to make sure that nothing was fat fingered or anything like that. And then once that is confirmed that next morning, then it'll interface back over to our SAP system.
Okay, great. Any other questions, commissioners?
This is Commissioner Olson. I do have a couple of other questions and some comments. The comment about the $1.8 million estimate and coming in at $686, was this one of the contracts that was modified based upon our decision to handle the changeouts ourselves, and therefore that reduction is because their scope of work was reduced?
Not necessarily. Yes, it was in relation to that internal labor strategy. But even given that, the 1.8 was our estimate for that amount. And, you know, obviously we wanted to stay conservative in our estimate. The numbers were quite wide ranging. The average was actually 1.4 million. So we did have a couple bids that came in over our 1.8. But we, you know, it is a unique strategy in a sense. And so we wanted to stay as conservative as we could with the estimate.
But the estimate was 1.8.
Correct.
You're coming in at 686. But the scope from the time you issued the RFQ was broader, correct?
No, we never actually issued the external labor strategy RFP. So we always reduce that scope of work in June and then release the new RFP.
Okay.
And that RFP estimate was 1.8.
Thank you. Okay. Number two, let's see. On the issue of, because we have changed how we're going to do the meter change out program, there seems to be a lot of interface in this with the activity that will be going on that we are actually doing the actual change outs. So I'm curious as to how this work will interface with the other work so that it meshes together and is not disjointed.
Yeah, it definitely goes hand in hand. And that was part of the reason of our goal of getting Aclara on board by this month, because obviously blueprinting sessions have started with the other vendors. And then we have MIV specific blueprinting sessions that come in October. So it was imperative to have them on board by then. And so, yes, there'll be some interfacing and integration work that'll be done behind the scenes, and then that'll allow that the pro field to then, you know, map over basically to our SAP system. So there's definitely some integration work. I believe Utigration is the company that's doing that for us. And all the vendors will be working hand in hand in coordinating.
Well, my question, I guess I used the wrong terminology. My question is, there are a lot of, what would you call it? A lot of, this is complex, and I'm sorry to, I always get back to this on this topic, but, you know, there's some, bringing up my note, you know, there's a myriad of other things that are going on that the district is now going to be handling. So I I've never been able to gel as to how that comes together in terms, is there a single point of who's managing that, or is it managed by department or whatever?
Mine has
to do with the organization of how that information comes together. In terms of the project steps.
Gotcha. Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
Travis, good morning, Commissioner. So I'm Kevin Lavering, a program manager for the Connect Up program. So yes, great question. As we have four main project work streams that are going on right now, and we are orchestrating those together. We have Z2 Solutions, as we mentioned last time, is providing guidance for us. They have helped other utilities orchestrate these various projects together. And so they're very, very intertwined. We're working them together. We have a master schedule that each of these projects is adhering to. And so we're making sure that each piece is folded into each other, and that we're all on the same track together also. So it's definitely in an organized fashion to have each of these projects governed within the same program.
So Kevin, are you then, in terms of the portion of the work that we are going to now do, are you the point person in bringing all these things together?
As far as all of the Connect Up projects,
well, in terms of things that relate to the specific change out activity. And like you say, there are different pockets of things to support that going on throughout the organization. And I keep harping on, who's the point person to oversee that? Is that you?
Yes. Yeah. For the overall program, I am the point person.
Okay. But the structure is such that you oversee anything related to this that each of those areas does.
Right. Yeah. And Tim Epps also in a leadership position within the program, helping out on the business side of things. And then each of the project managers reporting to me within okay. this program.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry, I continue to harp on this. I just my history, and that gives me comfort. Also, you all, in terms of this procurement process and getting this puppy on the, you know, up and running, I've done a very good job of continuity in terms of the contract process. And I so appreciate that. And I hope that carries over to really when we begin the journey. And this is a long journey over multiple years. So I hope that as the commission is, you report on progress or whatever periodically, that same effort is given to continuity in those presentations.
Absolutely. And we'll continue to report out on a regular basis to the commission. I think our next one that we're looking at November timeframe. We'll give an update of how each of the project work streams is progressing. Also give an update on how we're doing with the budget too.
Okay, good. Okay, thank you very much.
You bet.
All right, any other questions, commissioners? All right. Well, kudos for saving so much money. So thank you very much. Glad that worked out that way.
Yeah, great job, Travis and Kevin, with the explanation. And Kevin, maybe at the update in November, we can actually provide the commission with the org structure for the overall project. It kind of shows the leadership chain into the different aspects of the program.
I think you have, John, but I just want it reinforced so I can understand it. Thank you.
You bet. We'll include that too. Thank you.
Okay, next up is our BPA pass-through for fiscal year 2022-23, and Jason Siskowski. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning. Good morning, commissioners. I'm here to introduce Brian Booth, who will be presenting our BPA pass-through for fiscal years 2022 and 2023. Before I turn it over to Brian, I want to highlight the excellent work done by the rates, power supply, and legal teams on this rate case. Ultimately, a settlement was reached with BPA, but not all utilities in the region were in agreement from the start. The SNOPUD team did an excellent job of bringing folks together and working collaboratively with other utilities to keep costs low for our customers. I'm extremely proud of the work done by our team on this rate case. And with that, I'll turn it over to Brian.
There we go. Are you all able to hear me now?
Yep. Yes.
Perfect. All right.
You got out of bed this morning, Brian.
I somehow managed to delete my mute button here. So thank you to the clerks for saving me there. All right. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Brian Booth, Senior Manager of Rates, Economics, and Energy Risk Management here at the PUD. And thank you, Jason, for the introduction. Let's go ahead and hop right into it. This is our FY22-23 BPA pass-through presentation. Joining me this morning, we have, in order of appearance, Marie Morrison and Felician Eng. We also have Adam Cornelius's name on the presentation. He will not be speaking, but he was a key contributor to this. So thank you, Adam. So let's go ahead and hop into it. I believe we're going to hand it off right to Marie, who's going to be able to talk about the BPA pass-through. Marie?
Thanks, Brian. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Marie Morrison, Principal Utility Analyst, Power Supply. First, let me make sure that you can hear me. Can you hear me okay?
You can. Yeah. Good morning.
Great. Yeah, good morning. So let me kick off the presentation by showing you an overview of the BPA rate case. On July 28 of this year, BPA issued its final record of decision for rates that will take effect on October of this year through September 2023. BPA then publicly announced an average power rate decrease across all customers of 2.5%. Now, we know that BPA power and transmission rates affect each customer differently, depending on the products they purchase from BPA. So in terms of products, the average slice and block customer rate increase is 1.3%, and load following customers will see a rate reduction of 4%. As Jason already pointed out earlier, these rates reflect the outcome of the settlement that was agreed upon by BPA and customers, and it reflects significant benefits to customers compared to the initial proposal presented by BPA in the spring of this year. For transmission customers will see an average rate increase of 6.1%. Next slide. Please. All right. So here in this slide, I show you the high-level results of the BPA cost adjustment. The BPA pass-through calculations reflect the district's incremental BPA power and transmission costs in calendar year 2022 compared to calendar year 2020 for an apples-to-apples comparison. And here you'll see that incremental cost shows $500,000 change in BPA power costs and $2.7 million change in the district's BPA transmission cost. And these costs we express as a percentage of the district's retail revenue requirement and results in a proposed pass-through of 0.09% for power and 0.45% for transmission. And overall, the proposed BPA pass-through for commission consideration is 0.54% effective October 1 of this year. In the next slide, I'll walk you through the details of this calculation. So first, we take the district's forecast BPA power costs. Again, we take our power costs in calendar year 2022 and compare those costs with calendar year 2020, again, for an apples-to-apples comparison. And so on line one there, you'll see our total BPA power costs, both block and slice, at $235.2 million in calendar year 2020, relatively flat compared to calendar year 2020. And then next, we take our change in the volume of the BPA product. So here you'll see that in 2022, we're getting less BPA block and slice, about 0.37% less compared to calendar year 2020. That's about 3 average megawatts. And so the effective cost of BPA power is slightly higher in 2022 at $33.82 per megawatt hour. Next, we calculate the incremental rate impact. And here we take our BPA power cost using the new rate and the new volume and compare these costs with the rates that would have been if we take the 6.95 million megawatt hours, that's the change in volume, and take the old rate from what we're getting from BPA now in BP20. And so on line six there, you'll see that the rates would have been $234.7 million for us. And so we take the difference between lines five and six to get the incremental cost that we're getting from BPA because of that new volume, the change in volume for calendar year 2022. And we arrive at about $482,500. After that, we apply the utility tax rate, and that brings us to about $500,000 for calendar year 2022. In order to calculate the pass-through, we take that amount as a percent of our retail revenue requirement for 2022. And that brings us to 0.09% as estimated pass-through for power, and for transmission, that's 0.45% as estimated pass-through for transmission. So overall, the total proposed BPA pass-through is about 0.54%. And that's what we're taking to you for consideration today.
Questions so far, commissioners?
Nope, thank you. I have no questions. This is Mr. Olson, just a comment. This is one of the most clear explanations of how this all works. It's always kind of a mystery to me how you get from one point A to point B to point C, but I really commend the work that's been done on this one page clear explanation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The only part I'm struggling to, maybe I just haven't thought about it enough, is I understand passing on the new rate, and I understand passing it on at what we think the volume will be. I'm not sure what the 2020 volume has to do with it, right? That could be anomalously high or low. Somebody help me out. Maybe I'm just looking at this wrong.
So the 2020 volume is not actual volume, it was projected volume. So our expected price per megawatt hour is calculated from that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Marie. I think we can pass the torch over to Felicien now. Felicien, are you here?
Yes, I'm here. So it's Felicia Nang, principal utility economist here. On this slide, we wanted to mention that we do have a provision in place in all our rate schedule to address this PPA pass-through. You can read it, but it basically says that at the discretion of the commission, we may adjust our rates either up or down to reflect the PPA rate adjustments. And these rates will be adjusted based on our cost of service model, which you could see the details in the next slide. Here we can see the percentage increase by a different customer class in the very first top row here. As we mentioned earlier, the overall increase for the whole system is 0.54%. Based on our cost of service model, our residential class will experience just about 0.54%. Commercials will slightly lower at 0.53%, industrial at 0.68%, and streetlight finally at 0.35%. Just down below, we put a few monthly bill impact examples just to put things in terms of dollars. And as you can see, the impacts are fairly small. Even for a high user residential customer, we're still looking at less than a dollar impacts per month. The same goes for commercial on the high end, like if you were a large department store, maybe. They may see a $27 increase, but relative to their typical bill of several thousands of dollars, it's actually a minimal impact to these customers as well. And I'll let you glance through the rest of the numbers, but if there aren't any questions here, I will be passing back to Brian to wrap us up.
Any questions, Commissioner, for Felicia Stan?
No, thank you. No. Right,
thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Felicia. Before we wrap it up, I did want to touch base with you on a discussion that we'd had earlier this year. On February 2nd, we talked about, among other things, the possibility of consolidating our BPA pass-through rate adjustments with our overall rate design changes and general rate increases and to be a single event. Right now, we have the pass-through, which we hope will happen on October 1, with commercial rate redesign on January 1, and then perhaps a general rate increase on April 1. So there was some discussion of consolidating those for simplicity's sake. However, at this time, staff is reluctant to recommend this strategy. We really talked it over with our key accounts and reps, and we're just not comfortable trying to message all this at once, particularly this time around. So while we think the idea does have some merit in the future, we're not ready to do this now.
Commissioner Olson, good call.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Any questions on that part, Commissioners?
No.
All right.
So the next steps, we'll be returning in 2 weeks for consideration of amended rate schedules. We, of course, have our overly complicated spreadsheet that divvies out every little nickel and dime of these increases to the correct energy and demand charges. So we'll have that for your review as soon as possible. And then assuming that that's approved, we'd have a October 1 implementation. And right. that's all we have. Any further questions, Commissioners?
Oh, I have none.
Brian, I just have one question. This really goes back to Marie's slide. Are we satisfied at the mathematics of how the rates are distributed by Vonneville? In other words, that the following load following customers got a 4% decrease in the block customers got a 1.3 increase. Does that math all check out with us? I mean, I know we'd like it less, but is it fair how it's distributed amongst the customers in our mind?
Ooh, asking BPA customers whether BPA's cost allocations is fair. That's really a can of worms you're opening there.
we need to put helmets on for that one.
I will say that every time there's a rate case, there's some utilities bills go up more than others, and sometimes they go down more than others. Back in 2019, we got lucky, and our rates were very, very stable, while a number of utilities saw substantial increases. This time around, we weren't so lucky. I'll let Marie comment on BPA's cost allocation methods, but from everything that I've seen, it appears fair the way they've done it. Marie, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, let me see if I can answer your question, Commissioner Logan. Again, as Brian said, cost allocation is always difficult, but we had that slightly similar question earlier this morning while we were practicing the presentation. And load following customers get the benefit of net secondary revenues. And for this rate case, BPA forecasts an increase in net secondary revenues of more than $100 million relative to BP20. And that's why you're seeing an load following customer rate decrease of 4%. So they get the full benefit of BPA's net secondary sales. Slice block customers only get that benefit through the block product. We market our own slice and get revenues for that. And that's not captured in this 1.3% that we're showing here for slice and block customers.
Okay. Thank you. So it's a consistent methodology. I guess that would have been a better question. Okay. I see head nods.
Yes, reasonably consistent.
Controversial.
I understand that. I'm just trying to understand if at the end of the day, we felt they applied it consistently.
Commissioner Logan, this is Jason, and I would say that yes, we did. We didn't come out of it with a significant amount of heartburn. We did have discussions on whether or not their future kind of wholesale market price forecast was, in alignment with what we kind of thought and we're seeing, and we'll see on that. Certainly, this summer there were some higher prices, and we'll see if those kind of continue into the future. But overall, I think yes, it aligned with the cost allocation principles that they use and the different buckets that they push those costs to. So I'll also just highlight, once again, the excellent job that our team did. Originally, there was we were going to see significantly higher BPA rate increases due to revenue financing on both the power and transmission sides. And the settlement that our team worked with PPC and other utilities to put together really, it's saving our customers a lot of money. So really just excellent job by everyone involved in that process.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Thank you.
I'll pile onto that a little bit. Again, if you think back to the original forecasted or projected rate increases, they were significantly higher than what we were seeing. And as Jason mentioned, it was a collaborative effort across the public power in the Northwest, but also be very proud of the Snohomish team and the influence that Snohomish has through PPC, but also directly to BPA. And that is a significant factor in why the rates are much, much lower than originally anticipated. Snohomish really does carry a lot of influence on this process. And it's a huge kudos to our to our folks. Also, bravo. Great job.
Bravo. I agree. I follow those meetings and I realize that we play a major role. I mean, I want to clarify, I don't follow all of your meetings, but I follow the PPC and PNUC and NWPPA in those meetings. So,
yeah,
All right.
Yeah, well, a lot of things going on behind the scenes as well that, that we can be very proud of our Snohomish team that they are making a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And great job by Marie and Felician and Brian on the presentation. Again, putting it in a way that is easily understandable, something that's very complicated.
Yes, thank you. Go ahead, Commissioner Olson.
No, go ahead.
I just had one last question. Will we see any revenue when we sell power, like the transmission? I understand the power is at a market rate, but I know sometimes we sell transmission, right, to move the power. Will we be able to pass on that additional cost to those utilities we sell to?
Yeah, yes, Commissioner Logan. In short, we do make transmission sales with when we have surplus transmission, and we do see revenue through that. And Garrison or Adam, Marie, if you have anything to add to that, please do.
Yeah, that's just part of the overall power supply budget. So we do make revenue forecasts with that surplus transmission. The power scheduling team has done an awesome job, and that forecast has gone up year over year for the last several years. So we're seeing kind of a learned improvement in how to monetize that portfolio that we do have. So that's definitely part of that full picture.
Thank you.
Commissioner Olson, you had a question or comment?
Oh, I just had an observation. The weight and respect that Snohomish has, I believe, is a direct result of the quality of the resource experts that we bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
That's not only with this team, but throughout the organization.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely, Commissioner Olson. That's right on.
I agree. We're very involved in the process, and I noticed at PPC that our staff names are often thrown out as playing significant roles in this, not just in this, but our government relations staff and other staff. So,
and I consistently tell members of the public we have brilliant people in our employee ranks. I mean, just really, really smart. And I like for the whole world to know that. Good hirings, you know, good everything around it to support you guys too.
We truly
good salaries,
do.
Good salaries. That helps.
We are truly blessed with an amazing group of talented folks, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next up, Jason is going to continue to take the stage and give us an update, he and his team, on the Western Resource Adequacy Program, Phase 3A. All yours, Jason.
All right, thank you, John. So next up, we have Garrison Marr and Jeff Kallstrom. We're going to give you an overview of the Northwest Power Pool Resource Adequacy Program, how the district has been involved to date, and next steps. We do see, the district sees the Resource Adequacy Program as an important initiative to address forecasted shortages of capacity in the region,
mm-hmm.
and has played an important role in helping shape the program. There has been significant time invested in the program from our legal, power supply, power scheduling, and regional transmission planning teams. I'm once again very thankful that we have such expert team members and folks involved, and I'm grateful for all their hard work. And with that, I will turn it over to Garrison and Jeff.
Great, thanks, Jason. Can you guys hear me? Or am I talking into the void?
No, we hear you.
Hey, all right.
Loud and clear.
Perfect. Well, great. Well, this is the power supply double feature here. And we're going to be talking about the Western Resource Adequacy Program. And, you know, while we've been involved in power supply, we've got a really big team that's helped us take this on. And we're going to be talking about that, too. a big part of this team has been Jeff Kallstrom from our general counsel's office. And I want to pause real quick and just make sure Jeff's with me here, because we've got a tag team approach on this slide deck for you.
Yes, I'm here, Garrison.
All right. Well, now I think we're really ready to go. And if I can advance the slides here. Oops, but not that far. I'll tell you what we're going to talk about today. So first, we just want to do a refresher. What is the Western Resource Adequacy Program? And why is the district interested in it, right? Why are we participating? Why have we been trying to see this thing launch and be successful? We also want to say what has been achieved to date. You know, we've made it well through the planned process. And so what does that look like? What are the outcomes and the outputs today? So that'll be part of what we talk about today. Really, I think that the main entree, though, is we've got a decision in front of us, which is this phase 3A decision, which is the decision to continue participating in this regional program development. And we want to provide the staff recommendation for that. So that's, we're providing really the other components, right? This refresh and the results to date to set the stage for what our recommendation is and why we think that makes sense. And then we'll provide the next steps if that staff recommendation were to be adopted and paint a picture of what that looks like. So that's the plan for today. Does that make sense to everybody here?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good.
Perfect. Well, let's start at the beginning here. So, again, what is this program and why is the district interested? The first thing that we know about our region is that we are in a state of change. And some of the changes that are occurring in our region could be challenging from a reliability perspective. And there is not an existing mechanism for our region to consider regional reliability, but this program provides, a potential answer to that challenge. And these are some of the factors that are going on there. So the first thing that we know is that the bulk electric system's in transition. What we mean by that is some of the significant capacity resources in our region are slated for retirement. And with the patchwork of new state energy policies, what's anticipated to replace some of these big thermal facilities is gonna look a little bit different than what was there before. So we've heard a lot about, for instance, the coal strip plant, that Montana coal plant retirement. And we know that with CETA, and with some of our Washington state utilities, generally, what's slated to take the place there is some renewable energy resources, which is great from a carbon perspective, but we want to make sure that we really understand that reliability perspective as well. There are regional forecasts that show that the region could experience capacity shortages. These are things like the Northwest Regional Forecast that PNUC produces. Also, the council has a resource adequacy metric that's out there, and we've seen those start to flicker into the red here in recent years. But there is not a uniform system for utilities to plan for capacity and for the region to plan for capacity as a whole yet. What this program does is provide that framework and the mechanisms to see that that framework is utilized so that there is sufficient capacity for the region. And the last thing to understand about what's interesting about this is we have seen other states and other parts of the country, in the Western United States specifically, start to create requirements around resource adequacy. And we think that that framework is evolving pretty quickly. And this is one potential solution that could make sense because it's developed by utilities that really understand specifically hydropower and hydropower's contributions to resource adequacy. So this is kind of the landscape that this resource adequacy program is thinking about. And, you know, the district is a regional participant. How do we think about that and how do we fit in? The first thing to know about us is that we are a Block Slice customer. So we heard Marie, Brian, Felician, and Adam talk a little bit about how that's unique from a rate context. It's also unique from a resource obligation context. And generally, what our contract says is, you know, the BPA will provide us the block firm energy, and they'll provide variable slice energy. And everything after that is the district's responsibility. So we need to make sure that we are planning appropriately for enough resources to meet our customers' needs. And while we think we do that, this regional capacity issue will make us more confident and provide more insurance for that. We've seen in past IRPs that we do have an observed capacity need, that we have been acquiring capacity from the market. And you know, this resource adequacy would add some insurance behind that as well. And we also think that this program is one of several pathways that could lead in the future to organized market structures that would be important for us to understand and have a seat at the table for. And lastly, even though the district may have some seasonal periods where we're a little bit capacity short, BPA is in a slightly different position and is generally capacity long. And because this resource adequacy program really values capacity and provides some mechanisms to incentivize utilities across the region to procure capacity from peers, this could be an opportunity from BPA financially. And because we're BPA's largest customer, a financial opportunity to BPA could indirectly be a financial opportunity for the district. So if this program is successful, there could be, you know, a number of benefits that flow through, which is why the district's really interested in this. I want to pause just to see if there's any questions so far, because I've been monologuing just a little bit. And before I talk, you know, broadly about how the program works and what's been done to date, I just want to make sure that we're tracking on what we've covered so far.
Questions, yeah. Commissioners?
No, I've been following this closely through the other organizations of which we're a member. And I think it's very interesting and promising.
Excellent. Well, I will keep rolling then. So we've talked about, you know, what the need is, what the district's interest is. Now let's talk a little bit about how the program works. And before we said the region doesn't have this uniform metric for reliability that everybody uses and plans towards. So this program would create that, and that goal would be a 1 in 10 year loss of load expectation, or 1 day in 10 years. So really, right, high bar for reliability. And what would happen to make this happen would be that there would be a forward showing program where utilities would submit the resources that they have, the loads that they expect. The program operator would run simulations and would develop the metrics that's needed in advance for the region to hit this 1 in 10 loss of load expectation or higher. And there could be some resource sharing and resource exchanging so that utilities that are a little bit lower on this metric and utilities that are a little bit higher can do some resource exchanging so that everybody is able to collectively meet the target and individually meet the targets needed. And all of that data would be verified by this third-party program administrator. So before we talk, there's no uniform measures across utilities. This would provide that and provide the verification for that. And, you know, the outcome would be this regional reliability on this planning basis. Once we get to actual operational period, right, that time period where Mike Shapley and Kelly Wallace and their team does a great job of trading for what we need to balance our customers' demands and load with the generating resources that we have on hand. If we are short and it hits the program requirements, that could trigger a resource sharing mechanism where we can access this pool of shared resources. And that's ultimately how we can help increase reliability outcomes. So everybody's planning to make sure that we have enough pooled resources for the region. And if we hit these defined kind of probabilistic outcomes that are generally weather related, then we can have access to these shared resources to help us through reliability events. So I'll stop there and see if there's any questions just at this highest level, how the program is designed to work.
Questions, commissioners?
No.
Garrison, what would be a good example of how this would work when we had the our 20% single day record back in June? What were there utilities that were long that could share with us? And like, what would examples be of how this would work back then?
Yeah, that's a great question, Commissioner Logan. And that specific circumstance is a great picture of what this could look like, right? So in that that event, we actually did have this interim program stood up. And it used mechanisms a lot like the mechanisms that would be used by this program when it's fully operational. And what happened during that period, this four-day weekend with those record high temperatures, is that it did trigger that mechanism. And it did allow for utilities that had these kind of runaway loads to access a pool of shared resources. And there were resources available. And the PUD did call upon them. Ultimately, we accessed resources from Chelan PUD in that heat event because Chelan has excess capacity and had, you know, the ability to contribute that to the pool. So we would see that on an ongoing basis, but instead of kind of being an interim voluntary program, it would have all the mechanisms to bind folks for that resource pooling and would cover more months of potential need for the region.
Right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, great, so that's how the program would work at a high level. This is just a map of the footprint here, and if you're looking for our name like I did, I will beat you to the punch and just share, we're not on there because we're in Bonneville's Balancing Authority, so that's, you know, how we would be reflected there. But, you know, maybe the big takeaway is this is a big footprint, right? And that's one of the big advantages of this program. The greater the geographic footprint, the more resource diversity and load diversity there is in opportunities for parts of the region to share with other parts of the region. So if wind is low in the Columbia River Gorge, maybe it's not in Wyoming. Or if solar is just going wild in Nevada, maybe that's a boon to folks in other parts of the region that could rely upon that. So that's one of the strengths of the program and how this design brings that all together.
Garrison, Rebecca Wolf here. So all those colors in one wheel, interesting. So what, if you don't mind, what does AESO stand for?
Yeah, so that's, I know the A is Alberta, okay. And I might need some help with the ESO.
That's okay, but probably Energy System Operator or something. Okay,
right, and then yeah.
WAUW is Western. What, do you have any idea? I'm just always wanting to know what letters stand for, you know, what they mean, even though it's in the Northwest Power Pool area. I guess that's NWPP is Northwest Power Pool.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, okay. I'll confess, Commissioner Wolf, these entities that are kind of outside of the footprint are ones that, you know, we've maybe interacted with less in this program. So that might be a good one for us to get back.
It's just, you know, I mean, they're part of the West, and I'm, you know, with fires and all kinds of other things, I think that it's important, just important to be aware of them. And PSCO, I just would like to know what those are too. And then regarding Pacific Corp and Puget Sound Energy, they rely pretty heavily on gas, natural gas. And I've been listening to discussions about their, as you call it, heartburn, I guess. That's Jason's term. Yeah, they're having a lot of heartburn about what's going to happen to their loads and not being able to meet all of the state's transition programs like the CETA, because they cover more than just Washington, some of them. So I'm just looking at this. Now, Portland General is in blue. What do they do? Is that for profit?
It is, yeah. You know, one thing that I'm thinking, and let me know if this might meet the need, is, you know, our good friends in the commission office often tell us to avoid putting acronyms in our slide deck because they are a little bit inscrutable. I'm wondering if maybe we could address this by following up with an email that just spells out all these acronyms and making sure that...
That would be nice. What about Seattle City Light? I can't really see what color they are on this map.
Yeah, they've absolutely been participants today.
Okay.
If I can jump in too, there's an acronym cheat sheet that's a similar version of this map for a different purpose. And so I can tell you the acronyms if you'd like to know them.
Well, I think an email would save time. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jeff. So Puget Sound, and there's a little bit of Pacific Corp West down here. That's the same color, I think. Oh, anyway, mm-hmm. I just, you know, I'm fascinated by maps and I like to know what's going on in all of those. And I do see the green, the BPA. And Chelan it's pretty much independent from the BPA or less dependent on the BPA. Is that?
Yeah, it's its own balancing authority, which is why it's shown as its own area on the map there.
Yeah. And same with Grant. And Grant is doing a lot of innovative things with nuclear, and Chelan has hydro, right?
Yeah, and you know, that might be, you know, a great way to kind of wrap what the benefits are, right? Because all of these different utilities have different resources at their disposal. They all have, you know, different loads. Some folks might be summer peaking utilities and some might be winter peaking utilities. But by, you know, creating this regional standard that folks are planning towards and this uniform metric for do we have enough resources, we're able to set up kind of this insurance program and make sure that the region isn't, you know, headed towards a big capacity deficit without clear visibility of that. So it creates a signal to create enough resources to meet the needs.
And how does this relate to the deficits in transmission?
Transmission is a big part of what a resource is really counted as being able to meet that load. So in this program, for every megawatt, right, of generating resource that's counted towards the program, it needs to have at least 75% firm transmission service from the point of generation to the point of delivery in this program at least 7 months in advance. It still provides a window to firm up the remaining transmission, but it's absolutely a part of this program.
So according to your color wheel and the colors on the map, is Pacific Corp in?
Yes. Yeah, they would be.
Okay. And Puget Sound Energy is CN. I think that's what I read here.
Yeah.
And so I know recently I learned that quite a bit of power, I don't know how much, but some power is lost in transmission, especially long distance transmission. And so this is more like in the policy making area, but wouldn't we want to be thinking more about less dependence on transmission and more on having our own like rooftop solar and things that don't have to be transmitted over long distances? Maybe this for another discussion, but I'd be interested in just discussing some of that sometime. How can we reduce our reliance on so much transmission?
Commissioner Wolf, I think you've teed up a presentation that we hope to provide a little bit later in the fall, which is going to be on our integrated resource plan, or Snohomish, right, as a utility. What do we plan to do? And what are some of the advantages of maybe some of these resources that we could cite in Snohomish County? So I think you've definitely found something there, but maybe we could get into that a little bit further as we think about future resources.
I'm very, very, very excited about all of the initiatives that we're involved in to help save energy and produce more energy right here with our storage. And there's some new developments relating to storage that might be exciting too that I've been reading about. In even Time magazine, this last issue had a very exciting story about some new hope for storage. And I won't go into it now, but if you have Time magazine, take a look at it. It's about some very deep in the way down in the bottom of the ocean, these nuggets that could provide enormous amounts of energy if they were mined. It's way deep though, in the ocean, but there's hope everywhere.
yeah, absolutely. Well, maybe one kind of jumping off point from this map would be that these are the participants to date, right? And really what we're talking about today is, well, who will be the participants moving forward? Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a staff recommendation here that, we stay on the map here. Mm-hmm. And, we want to make sure as many of our peers stay on that map as well as we continue to develop this program. And just to circle back and say, this has been a really big team that's been looking at this. So members of Kelly's group over there in power scheduling, Jeff and Joe from the general counsel's office, folks from throughout the district. And part of the reason is, gosh, these committees on the right-hand side, those were about once per week at the height of this and several hours per meeting. So we were really investing some time into getting this right for the region and moving forward with a really smart program. Mm-hmm. And we are not done yet, which is what this process map shows. We've done a lot of the heavy lifting. We now have a design for this program, and we are at phase 3A, which would be launching this program as designed, making the final design tweaks to it without penalty, so that we can move into phase 3B, which would be the full implementation of this program. And that's when we would need to go to FERC and get approval for this program design as well. Mm-hmm. So this is a decision point for the district to continue as a participant here or to drop off. We do think that there's the possibility of folks that haven't been involved to date may join us. And ultimately, the more people or the more utilities that join this program, the lower the cost will be for everybody. So what have the results been and what did we accomplish in phase 2B? The first thing that we did is we have this detailed conceptual design document, 250 plus pages detailed. And there is a link to this document in the slide deck if that's of interest to folks to take a deeper dive there.
Yeah.
That's a big accomplishment because you can imagine getting all of the people on that map to agree on some pretty complex operational and planning choices. That really took some compromise and some great work. We also were able to define how to scope participation across this timeline. So, you know, that trajectory across, you know, the beginning point to phase 3B where the program launches, that wasn't fully formed at the beginning. And that was the other part that that was developed over 2B. It still allows the district an off-ramp if we decide that program participation isn't a good fit for us after participating in kind of the practice round in 3A. But that's something that was developed and is going to be really beneficial for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then last, you know, there's not a program like us in the United States because so much of resource adequacy in our region really depends upon the hydro resources that provide a lot of the capacity in our region. A really unique framework had to be developed in order to appropriately value that and apportion it out to, you know, folks like us that have a slice of the federal system. So that methodology was really important to get right to make sure that we had a cost-effective program. And we feel pretty confident that that methodology is going to work well for the region. So those are the big accomplishments of phase 2B. We're not done with design. There's still a couple tweaks and improvements that can be made, but we've got a pretty good framework. For the district, we learned a couple important things. The first is we have a better appreciation for what the regional risks are and what our individual risks are as viewed through the program. In general, this looks like for the region, less risk in the summer, more risk in the winter, and is, you know, our models would have, you know, affirmed previously. The same is true for the district. We're a winter peaking utility with more risk in the winter and less risk in the summer. We've identified some operational challenges for us to consider in the way that we manage risk in the short-term trading window. And we're working on strategies to approach that now. So how would, you know, some of the great risk reports that Mike Shapley brings to you on that quarterly basis, you know, how does that look with the resource adequacy program? And can we plan to align those things so that we have a clear strategy moving forward? We've identified those pieces. Commissioner Wolf, I believe you brought up the transmission component before. And John Martinson in our group has done a great job making sure that transmission is appropriately included in the design. And we've done a lot of analysis about the capacity of our transmission portfolio to work well in this program. And we think we're in good shape.
Jeff Kahlstrom has his hand up.
Jeff, I didn't see that. What are you thinking, Jeff?
I didn't intentionally put my hand up if it came up, so.
Uh-oh.
We can treat it as a high five.
Maybe we just want to hear from you, Jeff.
You'll hear from me in just a bit.
Okay.
Great. So the last thing that we learned in participation is that a lot of our peers view the resource adequacy program as a stepping stone to a organized market. This, you know, from our staff's perspective, means that it's really important that we're at the table, we're hearing these discussions, and that we have visibility into what could evolve from here. So having this third-party program operator that's looking at resource adequacy, which is a function of organized markets, you know, gives us, you know, additional incentive to continue participation. So now would be where Jeff and I would do this handoff, but I want to make sure that folks feel like they got their questions answered on what this program is and where we've been in participation so far, what we've learned and how we're feeling about it.
Any questions, commissioners?
Well, we'll have a chance to vote on this, but I think we definitely want to stay in it until we decide about whether we want to be bound to it.
Absolutely. Well, Jeff will tee that up for you in the slides that follow here.
All right, thank you, Garrison. So now we're going to jump into what phase 3A is, the components of it, and then also the costs associated with it. So go ahead and jump to the next slide, Garrison.
Jeff, I'm sorry. I don't remember if you introduced your title was introduced.
Yeah, I apologize. My name is Jeff Kallstrom. I'm Assistant General Counsel in the legal department working on these issues. So what is phase 3A? So phase 3A is, as we talked about, is non-binding. It is going to consist of two non-binding forward showing seasons in the winter of 22 and the summer of 23. There will also be a third non-binding forward showing, but that will be part of phase 3B. We will also get metrics for three seasons. So we'll know what our holdback is going to need to be and what our forward showing will look like for winter of 22, summer of 23, and winter of 23. And that includes our planning reserve margin and those calculations. In addition to the operation of the non-binding forward showing season, a very important part of phase 3A is the preparation for later phases, whether that's 3B or phases that come after that. And that includes preparing for filings that will be made with FERC, with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It'll be preparation for the formation of the independent board that will ultimately govern permanent operations of the resource adequacy program. And then very importantly, there are some outstanding design considerations that remain. And during phase 3A, we will work through those design considerations. So go ahead and jump to the next one, Garrison. And so this is where we get into what is expected of utilities who join 3A. First, we'll have to submit data on time within a schedule defined by the program, and that will allow the program operator to run the required studies, determining plan reserve margins and associated metrics. We will also be required to participate on the Resource Adequacy Participants Committee. Now, this is the decision-making body. So any decisions that are made during 3A will run through this body. And so as a participant, we will be a member of that body. We also would be a member of subcommittees. Those are the committees that are looking at potential regulatory filings, the independent board and transition to that independent board, modifications to the program, and also addressing any issues that come up during operation of a non-binding program. And so we value participation on the subcommittees very, very highly, because while those decisions will roll up to the RAPC, the decision-making body, the work gets done at the subcommittee level. Any questions before I jump into the next piece? I don't want to go too fast.
Questions, commissioners?
No.
Okay.
All right.
So then what benefits do we get out of this participation? So on the participant committee, so this is the decision-making body, we will be making decisions that set up the non-binding program. We will be able to finalize the final program design from an approval perspective. So again, we'll have the opportunity to vote on final design that has been brought to us by the subcommittees. There will also be data validation work. There's program modeling that's going to be going on, as well as some extensive and continued stakeholder engagement. Garrison mentioned the desire to bring in other utilities that have not yet been part of the development of the resource adequacy program. There's also outreach to entities that do not intend to join but are very interested in the program and what benefits and costs the final program may provide. And obviously the states that are impacted are interested in being involved in the program. And so all that is under the stakeholder engagement umbrella. And then we have the operational committee. And this is, again, we have the legal work for the FERC filing, the transition work, and then very importantly is the design perspective as far as the final program design. So being able to weigh in on the options to understand why one option was chosen versus another. The district has already had the ability to significantly influence aspects of program design. And we really value that, and we bring our perspective to, we hope to bring our perspective to continue to influence final program design. And that sort of kicks to the next slide.
This is Commissioner Olson.
Yeah.
Jeff, I have a question.
Yes.
On the second bullet on this page, or the first bullet, I'm sorry. It says from approval perspective. I kind of read into that, well, number one, how involved, what kind of authority do we have? I mean, does each utility come to the table with the same level of, let's see, we don't have a tier one approval, tier two approval. Am I not being, I don't know if I'm being clear.
I think what you're asking about is what it seems to me you're getting at is how is the voting determined? Like, how does approval actually happen?
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. So voting is, it's sort of a House and Senate approach. So you have 50% of costs are, and so this gets into costs, but also goes to voting. So 50% of your costs are paid for on a pro rata basis. Every utility, regardless of size, pays the same amount of cost, but in exchange, they receive the same vote. And then, but then 50% of the cost and 50% of the vote is divided up based on your P50 load in relation to all other participants in the program. So, so it's not a precise, it's sort of a balance between paying, you know, a small entity paying large costs, but getting a significant voice versus a small entity paying its quote unquote, you know, load share of costs, but then only getting a load share of votes. And so this was the compromise we came to allow every entity to have a meaningful voice in these votes. The other piece is that all votes coming out of the participant committee require a 75% approval. So this is not going to be a situation where, you know, just a tick over the majority can then bring the program forward. It needs to have significant support.
Okay, that was my concern. Is somebody going to run the show? And all right, thank you.
Yeah, no, and it's explicitly designed that no single entity has a veto power on the other side of it.
Or advantage. Okay, all right, got it. Thank you.
No one party can move it forward. No one party by itself can shut it down.
Okay, thank you.
So the perspective that the district brings, we've talked a little bit about transmission. We are right now the most transmission dependent participant in the development of the program. And so that brings us a pretty unique perspective and allows us to push, either push back on certain issues or bring experience to the table to make sure the discussion is fully illuminated and that everyone is on the same page as far as potential unintended consequences of actions. We are also the least resource-rich participant. We lean very heavily on Bonneville, and so we bring that perspective as well. We are also one of only two participants that is not a balancing authority, and then there are only a small number of Bonneville customers that are actively participating in development of the program. So we represent all of these perspectives that are really unique to other developing parties when it comes to forming this program. And we think that we bring value and we have had some success in shaping the program to accommodate interests of folks who might be in our same situation.
So, Jeff, how many Block Slice customers are in the program? What percentage, any idea?
I don't have an idea, any idea of number or percentage, but it's, I know Seattle is part of Tacoma, Eugene Water and Electric Board. Am I missing any other Block Slice, Garrison? No. I guess Seattle is Block only. They're not Slice anymore, but.
So my question earlier is, should we be, as we think about our future, think about how to become less transmission dependent?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely something that Garrison and his team consider all the time, is, you know, how to maximize what we have, but then also looking at what alternatives are out there as far as resource development, as far as different transmission products. And so I don't know if Garrison, if you want to jump in on that, but I know you're looking at that all the time.
Well, that relates to the second bullet point, the resource-rich participant part, that we are developing new resources to provide energy to our customers. And I think it seems like to me we should be just doing a lot more of that, such as a lot more solar where we can. I mean, there's a lot of development going on in our county, and I think that we could do, you know, much more solar if we wanted to. So for what it's worth.
Yeah, and I'll just, you know, jump in and say that's definitely something we explicitly look at the costs and benefits of in our long-term planning. And just thrown out there that one of the reasons we have that transmission dependency is because there's so much of that low-cost federal hydropower out there on the other side of the mountains. And so that transmission helps us access that. And, you know, that's our carbon-free capacity out there. So that transmission dependency that we have, you know, that it's helping us get to some of the really great regional resources that help us in really unique ways too.
Garrison, I would just chime in, and Jeff, a little bit to Commissioner Wolf's point or question. And I do agree for Snohomish specifically, to try to do more DERs is good for us. And as you've seen from our DER initiative and the utility of the future perspective, mm-hmm. we are focused on local resources. And mm-hmm. but from a macro perspective, a utility industry across the country perspective, transmission building is actually a pretty big deal right now. In fact, it's FERC has some work going on around transmission expansion, and that has much to do, or is tied directly to, how do you get the renewable resources to the load. So it's a pretty complicated topic, mm-hmm. but as Garrison has had teed up earlier, we'll get into more discussion in our IRP, and maybe it would be worthwhile for the commission to have a little bit of education on what's going on across the country regarding transmission build.
Yeah, well, it's a policy issue, but it's also a political issue. And so I won't go any further on that, but.
Yep, it sure is. And we don't want to get into the political side of that.
No, that would not be good.
I don't want this, Commissioner Olson. I don't want to belabor this, but Garrison, you've indicated what you have in the past bringing forward, the fact that you look at perhaps building more resources in our background, in our backyard, and that at one time was the board's policy and their focus. Just want to remind everyone that given the megawatts that we would have to serve, we would have to have some pretty big initiatives supported, that would need to be supported by technology that's still in development. Therefore, we're talking mega bucks to do that. And we're somewhat limited in what's available to us locally. And my final parting shot is, we've tried that before, and we didn't have a very good track record at it. Wasn't that we didn't try, but I'll be interested to see what you bring forward this year. I really get a little nervous about building in our own backyard.
I would just add to that, Commissioner Olson, because I think you're spot on all points. And it goes back to Garrison's point around us having the advantage of having BPA's
Cheap power.
Carbon free, cheap, yeah. Power and yeah, that is kind of the backbone of our supply for sure.
Definitely hearing you, commissioners, and we'll make sure when we bring forward the IRP later this fall that we're addressing some of these considerations, you know, in that presentation and conversation.
And thank I you. Guess I'll add on to that we're really living with decisions made more than 70 years ago. Those first two bullets, you know, this is the uniqueness of every utility. Is their sources and where their power is located, and so, you know, we're not a mid sea. All right, Jeff.
Okay. So the next slide, we're going to start getting into the cost and what this is from a monetary standpoint is what the impact is going to be. So as I discussed earlier. There are two methods for cost allocation. The first half of the costs are going to be split pro rata. This is the Senate method of both splitting the cost and voting. And then 50% of the costs are split based on estimated P50 load. This is the House side. Right now, the assumption is for 18 total utilities to participate, which is a slight reduction in what's participating now. And so we'll get into how that impacts the numbers here in a second, but it's also important to know that there are off-ramps available. So by agreeing to phase 3A, we are not agreeing to move into phase 3B. That will be a separate decision point that we will need to make at the end of next year. So just making sure that we're clear that this is really just 3A. We're not into 3B just yet. And so the next slide has the actual numbers to the district. So the overall contract amount is approximately $10 million for 3A. The district's share of that is expected not to exceed $657,000. However, there are two really important pieces to this number that we need to understand. First is that the actual cost obligation is expected to be significantly less than this amount. Given that there was a conservative estimate for the number of utilities, the number of entities that are participating in the program. In addition of this 657,000, 175,000 of that is additional costs that will be incurred by the Southwest Power Pool as they prepare for phase 3B. But those costs are not intended to be charged to the 3A participants unless the entire program fails to move to 3B. So stated a different way, Southwest Power Pool needs to do some modeling work and systems work to get ready for the binding program. It's a function of us attempting to move the program forward quickly, recognizing the need for the program. So rather than have a, you know, 8 to 10 month pause after 3A, while SPP does this work, they're going to do the work simultaneously. But the intention is they are not going to bill participants for that work. They're just going to eat the costs and for the time being, or they're going to delay billing until we get into 3B. However, if we never get into 3B, then those costs may need to be recovered. And that's what the 175,000 entails. And so, and again, it is not dependent on Snohomish by itself moving forward. It's the entire program failing to move forward. So if Snohomish decides not to participate in 3B, but sufficient utilities opt to move forward, then this 175 would not come back to the district. So it's akin to a liquidated damages provision, but it's really not. It's in the contract and it's a known number. For the 482,000, which is our share of the phase 3 activities, again, that is based on 18 entities participating and only 10 of those entities participating in the subcommittee level. And there's a cost difference. If you opt to only participate in the participants committee and basically only weigh in on decisions, but not have any role in the development of the proposals that go up, you can save, that will lower your financial contribution. But again, then you have no role in those participant committees. We have heard of a couple utilities that are thinking of going that way, but not a significant amount. And so if our expectation comes true, the vast majority of utilities will opt to be full participants. So that's another mechanism that will help reduce that cost. And what happens is the not to exceed amount is set. However, once everyone has signed up, the deadline is September 30th. So on October 1st, the budget will be reallocated based on who actually signed up. And that becomes our cost cap, which again, we expect to be notably lower than the $482,000. So there's a lot baked into this. So I want to make sure I answer questions on this, if you have any.
Questions, Commissioner?
Commissioner Olson, so off-ramps.
Yes.
We're at a not to exceed a certain amount, but who absorbs, let's say one or two utilities decide to leave once this has been executed, who absorbs the cost?
So there is, for phase 3A itself, once you're in for the full duration of 3A. So the off-ramp is for the program as a whole. At the end of 3A, you can decide not to participate in 3B. But once you sign up for 3A, you are in. So our cost can only go down. They cannot increase.
Thank you.
And then the other piece is there's always the potential for budget overruns and things like that. And so we were one of the utilities that pushed hard that said, you know, to the extent that these budget numbers adjust, it has to be 100% unanimous approval. So in other words, we as Snohomish need to agree, which then allows us to go through our governance process to obtain approval for that. So again, you know, back to that point, there is no circumstance where this can, these costs can increase without our consent.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right.
Okay. And then the one last piece I'll say before we jump to the next is that this is a contract with the Northwest Power Pool. We have a standard general services agreement with them that we've executed in the past that has the standard terms. And so, you know, we'll talk about this in a second, but what you will see is the work order portion of this. And we'll get to that in just a future slide, but I just wanted to make sure this is a semi-standard contract. So the next slide, we talk about the Bonneville Power Administration as our largest supplier and a significant supplier of energy to the region and a significant expected participant in this program. They are proposing to join 3A. They have submitted a draft letter to the region where they indicated that they are intending to join 3A. They solicited comments that were due on September 3rd. Snohomish did submit comments. We support BPA's decision. We acknowledge that there are still many questions to be answered, but our belief is that Bonneville's best avenue for answering those questions is to continue participating in 3A. Bonneville stated three main reasons why they believe moving forward in 3A is appropriate, they're very similar to our reasoning. First is that continued participation allows them to gather the information they need to better determine whether they should or should not continue beyond 3A and into the final binding phases of the program. And then again, Bonneville is very interested in participating in the design work that remains outstanding and helping to form the final program and how the final program operates. And then last is by participating in the non-binding phase, Bonneville can test the effectiveness of the program without risking financial consequences and without imposing operational requirements onto their operational team. And again, it's part of the information gathering and identifying issues, both for them internally and also for the program as a whole. And I think we support these reasons. They're very similar to the reasons that we have internally for wanting to continue with phase 3A. So we move forward to the next slide. And this is some detail around what the district looked at. We did a pretty, prepared a pretty detailed analysis of whether moving forward would be beneficial to the district or not. We looked at both quantitative considerations and qualitative considerations. On the quantitative side, obligations are looking to be in line with what the district's integrated resource plan is finding. And so that's definitely a positive. We are not looking at huge deviations. And then the operational strategy within the program does currently differ a little bit from the district's approach in the integrated resource plan. However, we are continuing to work with participants in final design. And if we can move the program in a direction where we think it needs to go, then that will bring the operational strategy of the IRP much closer to the operational strategy of the program. And so there's some important design work that that needs to be done. And we think that that will really help the quantitative side of the equation significantly. And then qualitatively, there are a lot of kind of non-numbers factors that really pushed us as staff to want to recommend continued participation. As we demonstrate regional progress, we're going to mitigate regulatory risk. We know the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is very interested in resource adequacy at a national level. We've seen the resource adequacy problems that have arisen on a regional level. And we know states are looking at resource adequacy issues. And so if we can demonstrate that we're moving forward towards a quality program, we can avoid having a program mandated to us. And we think that's very important. If the district continues to participate, we also have a significant opportunity to influence program design and costs. We were one of the loud voices pushing for a equitable distribution of costs, and that helped us get to the House and Senate approach we're at now. And we're still thinking hard as to whether the current approach to costs is really appropriate for phase 3B or if there should be something different. And having our voice in those conversations as a smaller entity is very beneficial and has the ability to move the needle quite a bit. And then like Bonneville noted, participation allows us to evaluate the benefits and the costs of the program because we have a very major decision coming up at the end of 3A. And the more data we have, the better we will be able to provide a recommendation to the board and the better opportunity the board has to make an informed decision. And then with respect to Bonneville, we've been coordinating with Bonneville pretty significantly. We've been supporting them whenever we can. And that has been very positive in the program. And we really appreciate the opportunity to continue to provide that support and to continue to coordinate with BPA. And this is both regionally as far as the development of the program, but it's also internally within the Bonneville footprint as we work with customers on how Bonneville itself is going to implement the program internally, how costs are distributed within Bonneville, how, for example, the slice product may or may not be affected by Bonneville's participation in the program, those types of things. And our involvement in the program puts us in a very unique situation to have significant input and influence in how Bonneville implements the program within its footprint. We've already seen that, and we're hoping to continue to see that. And then last is the governance structure of the resource adequacy program. While it's couched as just governing the resource adequacy program, we recognize that there are several utilities and entities that are looking forward and looking beyond resource adequacy towards Northwest markets. And you know, we are fully cognizant of the fact that the governance structure that is put into place for the RA program will be the foundation and the basis for the governance structure for future Northwest markets. So we really want to have that opportunity to influence that structure and set the governance up in a way that will be successful from our vantage point as it moves beyond resource adequacy. Any questions with that analysis?
Questions, commissioners, on this slide?
I have none. No more.
Commissioner Olson, I want to make sure I'm not misreading. On the slide 21, in terms of getting things more in line with our strategy approach, IRP strategy approach, I'm not reading into this that we're going to modify to what they want. I mean, our IRP approach is not going to be significantly modified to accommodate whatever ends up with this process.
No. So for example, one of the issues that we're facing, just to put a little bit of detail on it, is there are shoulder seasons. So you have the winter season, for example, but then you have the month coming into the winter season, the month coming out of the winter season. Right now, those shoulder months are treated exactly the same as the December, January, when we really do have a resource need. And so as a result, that's requiring us to hold significantly higher resources in those shoulder months than we otherwise would. And that's also a time when we have a little bit lower generation, but again, we don't have significant loads at that time. And so that's one of the pieces we're looking to influence, is how exactly the planning resource margin is calculated and whether it should be flat across the entire winter season or whether it should be shaped a little bit to more appropriately match what we really are seeing and what our need actually is. Because we don't want to be in a situation where Snohomish or other utilities are withholding significantly greater quantities than are necessary. And then Garrison, you can definitely add some more detail on that.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. And Commissioner Olson, you're right. We would be seeking to influence the program to make it more like our IRP approach, not the other way around. And just to put the finest point on it, we think if we're successful in this design tweak and we feel pretty comfortable that we'll have some progress here, that would be a significant cost savings for the district in the future when this program is stood up and that design is finalized and we're all planning towards it. So we think that, an investment in 3A participation will pay dividends down the road with a cost-effective design tweak that, would carry on in perpetuity. So that's kind of the opportunity. And Jeff described exactly, where we're seeing quantitatively that opportunity.
Thank you.
This is Jason. I'll just add on that the team has done a great job of identifying these different elements that we want to continue to try to influence in 3A. And already collaborating with other utilities that are seeing similar issues so that hopefully we'll have some momentum going into 3A to get these changes that we're looking for.
I'll just say that in my opinion, those qualitative considerations, especially those first two, are really huge. I think it's such a positive of the program that this is the product of public utilities, for-profit utilities, with different kinds of resources coming together, because we all have this resource adequacy challenge and it's only going to get bigger. And so I think it's a very positive approach and I'm really glad that we're playing such a role in it.
Excellent.
This is Commissioner Wolf. I am aware that the council, Northwest Power and Conservation Council, is releasing their 8th power plan. And I'm sure our people are studying it carefully, but I hope that we're not just outright rejecting what they're saying without, taking their point of view into account. So what is are we going to give it a fair look? Using the word fair again, are we going to be consistent? Is a better word, I guess, in looking at what they have come up with?
You know, I wonder, Commissioner Wolf, that that would be a better topic to discuss when we talk about IRP next time, because those would be the specific things that our utility would be doing in the future, and we could look at their recommendations.
Right.
I'd be happy to include that in that presentation. For sure.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what our team, not we the commissioners, but what the team is, if they have already taken a stance. A lot of the people in the PPC and PNUC, they just don't want to hear about it. They don't want to think about it. They don't want to believe that we might not be resource challenged, and that we can't deal with those in some more positive ways. So I don't know. I just want to know what our team is, what our position is on, you know, taking a look at it. And yes, Commissioner Logan, that's fine. we can look at it as we study our IRP findings.
So real quick, from a program perspective, the Western Resource Adequacy Program perspective, there has been significant engagement with the Northwest Power Conservation Council to understand, because in some cases their numbers are different. And so it's to understand that those differences, and then there has been open dialogue between those two entities. So it is absolutely has not been dismissive, and there has been dialogue.
Okay.
From a program perspective, Garrison can get into the utility specific perspective.
And I hear some members on PPC and PNUC talking about also people, especially from the for-profit side, talking about resource neutrality, or what is the word when you're skeptic?
Agnostic.
We should be, that we should be resource agnostic. Well, that's hard to be if you're an environmentalist. So that, you know, that gets into different perspectives on what is important for our planet, for our children, for our wildlife, for our fish, you know, those kinds of things. And yes, I like the positive side of hydro, but there are negatives, and we don't talk about those enough, in my opinion. And I know the tribes don't have as big a voice as a lot of other entities in these processes. So anyway, you know, I'm really concerned about our fish right now. And I think we're doing great things on the program up at the Sultan project. That's my favorite project really right now. So I'll thank you very much. I'll say goodbye.
Just to put a bow on it there, you know, we'll bring back some discussion on resource adequacy and how we plan. But I do want to just make quick mention that, you know, the council is supportive of the resource adequacy program. Uh-huh. And that this program is not at all in conflict with any of their findings or any of their recommendations. So,
That's
good. These are kind of mutually beneficial things that are, you know, all thinking about this regional challenge from different perspectives.
Thank you for saying that. I was not aware that there was no conflict at all. Mm-hmm. That's good.
I would just add, you know, kind of our approach from a power supply perspective and district perspective is to work as collaboratively as we can with other utilities, the council, and even if, you know, there are some differences, we want to seek to understand what those are and have good conversations with them about those. And to Garrison's credit, you know, earlier this year, we had a conversation with one of their planners and found a lot of similarities between our IRP process and their planning process and kind of some of the things that we were seeing there. So, and we can elaborate on that in the IRP discussion. I think that
okay, would be thank you. That was a good suggestion by Commissioner Logan.
Commissioner Olson, do you have something you wanted to add?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Any further discussion on this slide before I move to the next?
Nick, we're good.
Okay. So the next slide, we have the staff recommendation. So district staff, as you can tell, we recommend participating in phase 3A of the initiative. We recommend being both a member of the Resource Adequacy Participants Committee, as well as a member of the Operating Committee and any other subcommittees that may be formed. We believe, you know, there will be additional staff commitment in, to participate in the Operating Committee and additional financial committee considerations, but we believe it's worth it. And the numbers we gave you before assume this level of participation. Mm-hmm. And so, oh, go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. So then the next slide is next steps. So we're going to come back. We intend to come back to the commission at the September 21st commission meeting with a resolution seeking support of moving to phase 3A. We would then, if we are able to obtain that support, we would execute the phase 3A work order with the power pool. And again, for the contract piece of it, this is a work order under the general services agreement with the Northwest Power Pool, which is a little bit of a cleaner contractual arrangement than coming back with something completely new. The district would participate in the non-binding phase of the program, continue development of the Western Resource Adequacy Program, and then evaluate the potential for district participation in phase 3B or future phases. We don't know exactly yet what the next decision point will look like. We just know there will be a decision point towards the end of 2022. Mm-hmm. And that's the conclusion that we have. We have a couple of slides at the end in the appendix that are informational, just to provide you with a little bit more detailed information and a couple of links where you can find even more information. And so with that, I'll open up the questions for Garrison or I.
Questions, commissioners, comments?
I have none.
Okay. I'll just say, you know, thank you again for being so involved. The three commissioners have seen several presentations at PNUC by Frank DeFrangi on this. And so it's really good to get our understanding, a deeper understanding on our part. And, you know, this, I think, Commissioner Wolf sort of hit on a couple of aspects here. You know, there's really, in my mind, two huge challenges in the region. One is getting to 100% clean energy, which is going to be different for every utility. And then one is resource adequacy, which really will require our working together to ensure it. So they're linked, but they're also separate in some way. So two huge challenges, and I'm really glad that we are working cooperatively on this, and hopefully it'll mean that we will have control of this in the future. Utilities will, and we won't have our Cal ISO thrust upon us or something. So, great presentation. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank Anything you. Else this morning, John?
No, I just was going to say great job walking through that to Garrison and Jeff. And that is it for our CEO report.
Okay. So we do have some time for public comment this morning. If there's anyone from the public that would like to comment, please raise your hand. Or if you're joining by telephone today, dial *9. I'm not seeing anybody. So it's now 11:08 and our meeting is recessed. The regular meeting will reconvene here virtually at 1:30 p.m. Thank you all. See you in a bit.